Hello and welcome to this podcast on the latest strategies for improving corneal sensitivity testing and diagnosis of patients with neurotrophic keratitis. In this episode, which includes excerpts from a recent educational symposium, optometrist John Gellis and ophthalmologist John Hovenesian discuss the practical testing strategies that eye care clinicians can use to identify NK earlier in patients. They also talk about the findings from the pivotal THINK study and highlight the applications of different quantitative and qualitative corneal sensitivity testing devices. This activity is provided by PER and supported by an educational grant from Dompay and Brill Engines. To begin, Dr. John Gellis introduces the concept of neurotrophic keratitis, describing its pathophysiology and clinical presentation. Then, Dr. Hovenesian weighs in on the clinical spectrum of NK by diving into the advantages and pitfalls of the classification systems commonly used.
So we're going to get into diagnosing neurotrophic keratitis. So really, what is neurotrophic keratitis? NK is really a degenerative corneal disease, which is really characterized by a reduction in corneal sensitivity, breakdown of the epithelium, and impaired corneal healing. When we look at these patients, NK can lead to the development of corneal ulceration, melting, and perforation kind of in its later stages of the disease. Dr. Hovenesian, when you see NK to start, you know, what level do you typically catch this at?
Well, as we're going to talk about shortly, we're seeing a lot more NK, most of us, than we think we are. And the earliest stages of it really look an awful lot like dry eye. And that's why any test that, suggests a findings of dry eye may also be indicating that there's some neurotrophic keratopathy. So really the gold standard for diagnosing it, of course, is sensitivity testing. And what we find is in many cases, you don't have a, this is a fairly advanced stage, stage two or greater, that we see in the upper picture here with the rolled edges and the well-defined persistent epithelial defect in the cornea. So it certainly can lead to these things, and it's pretty ugly when it does.
Yes. Yeah. It's funny because, kind of people think, NK, the classic presentation is this big meaty ulcer that's never healed. It's got these gray rounded edges. And that's just not the case anymore. You know, we can recognize, signs of NK much, much earlier. In this patient here, you can see, again, more of that classic NK, late stage NK that we would think about with those heaped rolled edges, obviously where I like to call it, they have a stain but no pain, right? These patients where, the signs are out of proportion with the symptoms, and, the corneal epithelial irregularities are there. And the stromal involvement that will happen with these, where we start to get that corneal ulceration and melting, and in the in-stage perforation. But again, it's a spectrum, just like you were saying. So this kind of comes into the classification. So John, if you want to touch on this just a little bit, this is kind of something that's, even changed since, we started having interest in NK when, things like Cernegerman came out. So.
Yeah, it's right. We really never paid too much attention to the earlier stages of NK because we weren't sure exactly how to define them. And, it's not a common practice for clinicians to test sensitivity. It's time consuming. It's not reimbursed. It often doesn't change things very much in our treatment unless we're dealing with a specific disease. And we know that, for example, when you're trying to diagnose herpes simplex keratitis, it's enormously useful in pointing you toward or away from that diagnosis. But a lot of clinicians don't use it for a lot of other in a lot of other places. So the staging is helpful. Because we realize there are the early stages. So starting at the earliest in the NK study group, we've got kind of one stage. Their stage one really doesn't involve any disruption of the corneal epithelium, but it's just altered sensation. So a fully healed eye is still considered stage one. Two for the NK study group is considered one in the Mackie classification. And that's where you have, so in the NK study group, it's punctate epithelial keratopathy without stromal haze. In the Mackie classification, it's just any punctate keratopathy. It doesn't have a lot of regard for stromal haze, and that's why there's some crossover between stage one and two in MACI versus the other stages in the NK study group. And then as you progress to more advanced findings with stromal haze, you get in higher stages. As you get persistent epithelial defects with ulceration, you get into stage four and then stage five, and then finally perforation is the at the highest grade. The MACI doesn't distinguish between ulceration and perforation. It's already stage three. So really just three stages in MACI and five, six in the NK study group.
And I've always found that, when I'm looking at this, when you had the classic, oh, this is NK, it was always, oh, it's, I'm thinking in my mind stage, two and three on the, on the MACI classification where there's already a well-defined. But, I think the NK study group really does a good job of kind of, outlining what those earlier stages are and really what we're probably seeing in a lot of cases. We've both seen those cases, obviously, when you have that patient that you're going, it's run-of-the-mill dry eye, let's throw, our typical stuff at it, and they come back on follow-up and you're like, well, that looks exactly the same. It didn't respond to that at all. And you're going, oh, okay, well, this may not be just run-of-the-mill dryness. This may be a reduced sensitivity that's actually not allowing this cornea to heal quite as well.
When you have treatments for disease, you tend to look at the disease differently and in greater detail. And that's really kind of what we're going through as an eye care specialty now, is thinking about an NK and the spectrum of that disease differently, because we have more tools at our disposal for treatment. So it's important. It's becoming increasingly important to diagnose.
I mean, this is, when we look at the barriers of diagnosing, I think you touched on this very nicely, which is that, unless we're checking for it, we're not going to find this in a lot of these cases. If I saw just kind of run-of-the-mill SPK, I may just blow by the diagnosis of neurotrophic keratitis if I'm not actually touching the cornea to check the sensitivity.
That's right. And it part of the problem is what's kind of outlined in this first bullet point is that we generally think of NK as the way we used to think about it, as an orphan disease, a rare disease, an uncommon thing that happens just to a certain subset of our patients. But that's not where the peak, that's not where the majority of patients with NK are, right?
Exactly. Now, I do want to go into this study here. I think this was probably one of the best studies that's ever, been involved in this sort of thing because it brings it to a practical level. And this is your study. I mean, we can think about all these other studies, the phaco studies and all those sorts of studies that they've looked at, dry eye and, ocular surface signs in patients who were getting ready to undergo cataract surgery. But I think that this is really, really interesting. So I'll let you go ahead and kind of run with the ball here.
Sure. Yeah. Well, so the THINK study, THINK stands for testing hypoesthesia and the incidence of neurotrophic keratopathy. And the sort of the origins of this study were another study done by my good friend Bill Trattler in Miami, who looked at patients presenting for cataract and what the incidence of dry eye was in his study called the phaco study. And in that study, he found that almost two-thirds of patients presenting for cataract evaluation had signs of dry eye. About two-thirds of those did not have symptoms of dry eye. So there, this asymptomatic large majority of our cataract patients that we're kind of ignoring, if well, that we better not ignore. And the reason we better not ignore it is because we've done other studies I published a few years ago that if you clean up the ocular surface before cataract surgery, you can improve the accuracy of the refractive outcome. It's certainly, even if you don't improve the refractive outcome, you improve the quality of vision. You improve the high order aberrations that you'll measure with aberrometry. So it raised, though, for me, the question of, well, why is that? Why do these patients not complain about their dry eye? Could it possibly be that they have a form of NK? And it turns out that a large portion of them do. But what we did to study it was to just take patients coming into the eye clinic who have dry eye, and not just like most other parts of the country. I'm in Southern California, where it also can be dry. We see a lot of dry eye among our cataract populations. We did central staining without anesthesia, and tested tear breakup time. And for those patients who had both a reduction in tear breakup time and some degree of corneal staining, we defined that as the dry eye population. And you know, if you know anything about dry eye, you know that once you reach a stage of corneal staining, it's not just mild dry eye. That's moderate to severe dry eye. You're breaking down the ocular surface. So these were not patients with just very subtle dry eye findings. And we tested corneal sensitivity. And when you have dry eye, one of the challenges is that if there is coexisting reduction in corneal sensation, it's going to tend to be bilateral, right? And so a cotton wisp test is a wonderful comparative test. And as you gain experience with it, you learn how to be a little bit more quantitative with it, even if you have bilateral reduced sensation. But a Cochet-Bonnet anesthesiometer, and I think you've got some slides later describing how that instrument works, is really the gold standard for measuring corneal esthesiometry. So we used a Cochet-Bonnet and tested. We also tested symptoms, looked at conjunctival hyperemia and vision, as well as corneal higher order aberrations. Why don't you go ahead and advance to the next slide? Here's really the money shot. This is where the findings were shocking to me. So this is 31 patients, and the distribution of patients between reduced sensation, where the cutoff, if you look at all the literature, 40 millimeters of exposure on the Cochet-Bonnet anesthesiometer is about, that's the threshold for what's considered abnormal. And higher levels on that test mean higher sensitivity. And if you're not familiar with this instrument, you will be when Dr. Gallus kind of describes it in the talks over the video that's coming up. But so lower numbers means a cornea that has less sensation. We found that 58% of patients, go ahead and advance it, that graphic will show up. 58% of patients had a loss of sensation along with corneal staining. That qualifies as Mackie stage one neurotrophic keratopathy. And so this was 31 patients, as you see at the top. We actually, the study was 60 patients, but the finding was so shocking and statistically significant that we published before the study ended because we just thought this needs to get out there. And after completing 60 patients, the percentage is not 58%, it's 61%. I think it was 61% on those 60 patients. So furthermore, we looked at how the correlation went between corneal staining and esthesiometry. So to be in the study, you had to have at least plus one corneal staining, but it could be anything more than that. Those patients who had the more advanced loss of sensation, meaning less than or equal to 30 millimeters exposure with the Cochet-Bonnet test, that's where you tended to have the clustering of the patients with grade two or higher staining in the study. Now, this correlation was not statistically significant. Sort of makes sense, though. If you've got less sensation, you may end up having more stain. In our study, which really was not powered to look at the implications on vision and on higher order aberrations in the cornea, we didn't find statistically significant correlations between loss of sensation and a loss of corneal smoothness, if you will. I think a larger data set would certainly turn out that result because there was a trend. It just wasn't statistically significant. We didn't design the study to determine that. So, you know, for me, the biggest takeaway on that study is that we're seeing a lot of NK in our practices that we would never think is NK. And that when we see patients with dry eye who have NK, we probably need to treat them differently. But it really begins with diagnosis. And so, why don't you, if you would, talk over this slide, John?
It's great because of how much that kind of correlates with the phaco findings, you know, and really helps to explain those asymptomatic patients that they were finding with dry eye. So, yeah. Now, when we get into kind of diagnosing the history and these sorts of things, you know, we can think of four main classifications here that are, you know, kind of areas that may be, you know, contributing to the diagnosis of NK. You have your ocular, your systemic, your genetic, and your central nervous system. Generally, I like to think of this as what are the big ones that we're kind of thinking about, right? When you go to ocular, the first thing you got to think about is herpetic infection. Big, big one. when you go to systemic, you got to be thinking diabetes, right? When you get to central nervous system, I mean, there's a variety of different factors here. When you think of central nervous system, Dr. Hovhannissian, what are you thinking is kind of your number one kind of jumps out at you sort of diagnosis for this?
Yeah, I mean, we see a fair number of patients who've had strokes or other, CNS anomalies that are one of the causes. And then acoustic neuroma surgery is pretty common as well. And that, frequently causes significant loss of sensation and also motor, to the seventh nerve.
Yeah,
Yeah.
definitely. Definitely. And then for the genetic side, we don't, I wouldn't say we see a ton of these patients, obviously, because there's not a ton of them out there. But I do care for quite a few familial dysautonomia compared to, the general population. I have a much higher percentage of the general population in these patients. But those patients are a, the second you hear that, you go, oh, yeah, we need to check you for NK.
Right.
But the other thing that I think is very important to cover in the history of this is drug toxicity. When we're adding things to the ocular surface, so your patients who are glaucoma patients, your patients who, are chronically putting in preserved, medications or topicals onto their eye, the effect that that can have in, affecting an ocular surface and contributing to neurotrophic keratitis, as well as those undergoing ocular surgery, retinal surgery being, one of the big ones for this, followed by various different types of refractive surgery too. So, and corneal based surgeries. So, any sort of really ocular surgery. Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. And I think the honestly the biggest one in that biggest box, ocular, is going to be just chronic ocular surface injury, which is what dry eye
Yes.
is, and
Yes.
inflammation. I mean, if such a high percentage of our population has it, and it's a chronic disease, and such a high percentage have NK, well, there you go. It all ties together. So that probably is going to become the number one cause of NK as we redefine this disease from being a rare event in patients with debilitating, highly identifiable, rolled edge corneal epithelial defects, to something that's much milder. I think we're going to look at dry eye as being number one on that list.
Yeah, definitely. Now the question is then who do you test and when, right? In my practice, anybody who's got any level of kind of, corneal epithelial staining, I am, checking their corneal sensitivity. So basically anybody who's coming in for a dry eye evaluation who has already been identified as having corneal staining, they just get corneal sensitivity testing immediately. That's just part of the workup. Now on the flip side of that, if I'm seeing them, let's say I see them for the first time, I'm going to, stain my patient just like I normally would. I don't use any anesthetics to do my staining, though. I just use a little bit of saline for this. And then I'll go ahead and do my corneal sensitivity staining after that, although that's not going to give me a true unadulterated, corneal sensitivity. Obviously, we still haven't put any anesthetic on the eye, though, so we get some idea of it. But John, when are you looking at this and saying, hey, this patient, no matter what, when they're first coming in, they're getting, corneal sensitivity staining versus the one where, oh, I'd wait until I discover something to do the sensitivity staining?
Yeah, it's a great question, and I think that to start with the end in mind here, I think we're heading toward a time when devices like the Brill engine for measuring corneal sensitivity become kind of standard of care as we bring patients into practices, especially older patients or patients who have other corneal disease, because the workflow certainly in an ophthalmology practice is a little more complicated because typically the patients see a technician. Docs want them to have the pressure tested, which usually means that there's an anesthetic placed in the eye. So, getting to the point where you suspect it and then test it kind of doesn't work.
Yeah.
I do think for cataract patients, where we typically bring them back on a different day for biometry, we're going to start to more readily include esthesiometry testing with some device, just so we identify who's at risk for trouble healing. But you know, test it the moment you think about it, and test early and test often, just like voting.
Love it. Yeah, and it, you know, it's a simple thing to do. And right now we're going to show you some tools and techniques for checking corneal sensitivity. You know, there are classic esthesiometers. We use the word meter because we are actually measuring something quantitatively, not qualitative. You know, so for this, you're looking at, you know, your Cochet Bonnet. I've actually never seen a Belmont in real practice. Have you ever seen a Belmont?
I've not used one or seen one, no.
Yeah, neither have I, but this is a non-contact gas esthesiometer. But there is one that is much more prevalent, new to the market, and that's the Brill non-invasive corneal esthesiometer, which uses a pneumatic force for checking or measuring the sensitivity of corneas. And then you have kind of your your qualitative, you know, your not so advanced measures of this, which is just kind of, do you feel it, do you not? Do you feel it a little more in the other eye than the other, right? Which are going to be your cotton tip or your, you know, tissue paper, where you're going to roll the tip into, you know, a fine line, or you're going to use a little dental floss for this. Frankly, and I am a little bit biased towards this, but you know, those can be fine for a screening. But even that, I think, is beyond inadequate. But, you know, if you got nothing else, do something, which is do that, right? Now, why do I rail on the cotton tips? So me, my ophthalmology resident and my optometry fellow, I said, okay, each one of us is going to make a cotton wisp. Okay, now hand those to me and let's take a photo of it. You can see that there's different thicknesses of each one of those cotton wisps, different lengths to those cotton wisps. None of them are the same. And what you'll see is when we do our video here. Okay, so basically what we're doing here is I'm going to go ahead and use that wisp to touch the cornea. I'll have you go ahead and loop the video real quick, because what you'll see is that on her right eye, when I touch her right eye, she has no response to this. She shakes her head, no, I don't feel this. When I go to touch the left eye, her left eye, yes, I do feel that, right? But when I say, do you not feel that? Does that mean you have no sensitivity? Does that mean you have reduced sensitivity? Do you have partial sensitivity? And we just don't have enough strength in the device to be able to figure this out. So you can see here, when I go ahead and open up her lid, I touch her with that cotton wisp. You can see she has no reaction at all. Now, the one thing that I am not doing in this demonstration is I'm not checking all five quadrants of the cornea, which is an absolute important step for this if you're really searching for NK. You know, what you're seeing here is I'm just touching the central cornea here, and you'll see in this case on her left eye, she does indeed feel that. So when we tell her, when we ask her, you know, quantitatively, yeah, well, you felt it in your left eye, you didn't feel it in your right eye. You know, we don't really know where we stand. Is this a fully neurotrophic eye on the right side or not? So when we get into the Cochet, let's go ahead and run the Cochet esthesiometer image here. What you're going to see, so this is a Cochet Bonnet. You can see that there are these markers on there. So you have 60 millimeters or 6 centimeters, all the way down to zero, right? And what that is the length of the nylon fiber that's coming out of this. So you may have remembered from optometry school, or you know, your ophthalmology residency, when they said, oh, these were done with horse hairs back in the day. You know, what this is done with now is a nylon fiber, and that nylon fiber at various different lengths is going to have various different stiffness. Kind of think of it even like this piece of paper, right? If I hold it from the end, it's going to flop over. If I hold it very close here and shorten it up, you can see that our edge here at the front, let's go ahead, there we go. Our edge here at the front is much stiffer than it is at the edge. So as we shorten the length of this, we have a stiffer piece of an instrument to touch the cornea with, and thus more force, and thus we can measure a stronger response there. So for a patient who, in this case, when we go to our patient here, you'll see that I touch her cornea with the 40 millimeters that Dr. Hovhannissian had just talked about being kind of that threshold for normal. I touch her with that on the right eye, and you see she says, "No, I don't feel that." What I then do is I shorten the filament to 30 millimeters, and then I touch her cornea again, and she says, "Oh, yes, I do feel that now." So it's not that she has no sensation like what we thought with the cotton wisp. It's that she has reduced sensation, and she's not hugely reduced. She's reduced slightly below the normal level. Now, when we go to the other eye, her ipsilateral situ, her left eye here, what we're getting here is again a 40 millimeter measurement here, and she does respond to that, saying that yes, I do feel that, so indicating that she is above that normal threshold in sensitivity. When I do these tests, I generally start at the 40 as kind of here's my marker. If they feel it, great. I know that they're greater than 40, greater than that in sensitivity, so more into the normal side. And if they don't feel that, then I shorten it and find out exactly where they're at for reduced sensitivity. Dr. Hovhannissian, how are you kind of using your Cochet for this?
So, great demonstration you're giving here of it, and this video is terrific. By the way, you can also do it at the slit lamp for those
Yes.
who are more presbyopic and really want to know what sector they're testing. That does help so that you can see where it's actually touching the cornea. But you don't have to. If you can see well enough, then you can test this way. I usually start with it longer and then shorten it. So I want to be a threshold test. I want to start where they don't feel it at all, even if they're normal, and then shorten it progressively to see where the threshold is. So
I
that's
love that.
yeah.
That's great. Yeah, that's awesome.
Think the instructions for the Cochet-Bernet actually say that. I could be wrong, but I'm pretty sure that's what's in the instructions. And so
Yeah,
for that way.
that is my the way that I do it is kind of how I'm doing when I'm like screening a patient just to say, do they feel it, do they not?
Yeah, it makes perfect sense what you do. It's a time saving, and it really gets to the point of is it considered abnormal or normal? Very,
Our
very right.
next one here is going into the Brill here. So the Brill esthesiometer. So this one's kind of an interesting one. So this is a device where it has been it's creating these micro air pulses, and these micro air pulses are controlled from one up to five stages, and each one of those has a different pressure associated with it. And this is actually calibrated against the Cochet-Bonnet, but it's a much more linear scale. The Cochet-Bonnet, as you shorten the filament on it, you get an exponential increase in force. Whereas with the Brill, you get actually a linear increase in force as you change to the various different levels. Now, on this, what you'll see is I get that tip relatively close to the eye here. And what we're trying to do is you can see those Purkinje images on the cornea, those little reflections. All we're trying to do is get to the point where those two Purkinje images kiss, and then we go ahead and click our button to cause the pulse, and then we just see does the patient feel this or not. In this case, what you're going to see is this patient is basically all I'm doing here is just lining them up because they have a little bit of a strab. That being said, this is actually a patient so who consented to be able to do this, but this is what we're doing in the actual testing for her. And as we go in, we're going to go ahead, get our Purkinje to overlap, and then we'll go ahead and cue the pulse, and we'll see, do you feel it or do you not? So in her case here, we again set our threshold at the normal level on both eyes. I started at, a grade two or three is considered a normal level on this. Grade four is reduced sensitivity. Grade five is significantly reduced sensitivity. Grade one is actually a hypersensitivity. So if they respond to a grade one, you know that you may have a hypersensitive patient on your hand. So kind of an interesting way to kind of work through their threshold there. That being said, one of the things that I have not done in any of these demonstrations, which is very important, is to test all the quadrants of the cornea. Now, we can argue practicality in that, but that is really what you want to be doing for kind of, gold standard, checking, if you will. So now when we get into kind of treatments, our treatments for this are going to be, your early stage treatments. We look at obviously lubrication therapies, way to, reduce inflammation, punctal occlusion, therapeutic contact lenses, sirnegermin for this. But, kind of our simplest factors for this are, elimination of topical preservatives, reviewing their systemic medications, and then really just optimizing their ocular surface, through lid hygiene, tear substitution, those sorts of things, as kind of our early stages. As we get into our advanced stages, and these are kind of classified by the Mackie scale here. You can see stage one and two versus stage three. In your advanced stages, this is where you start to get into, surgical interventions. Use of tissue adhesives, things like conjunctival flap or corneal neurotization, keratoplasties and other immunosuppressive therapies that would be systemic. A variety of different sort of ages are or approaches on this. Any comments here, Dr. Hovhannissian?
Yeah, a great review there. I would certainly say that start simple. As you said, preservative-free eye drops, lid hygiene. I think hypochlorous acid for a lot of patients is very helpful. In some cases, punctal occlusion, just increasing the tear lake. And don't forget about Demodex. Just as we're changing the way we think about NK, we're also changing the way we think about ocular surface disease because we now recognize that Demodex is more common than we really recognize because we never looked for it. And the reason we never looked for it is because we never had a really effective and easily implementable treatment. Now we do with lotilaner. And so treat Demodex if you have it because it's a huge and common problem and it's very treatable.
Thanks for listening to this episode. For more detailed information, additional resources, or to access other CME activities, please visit our website at gotoper.com. Don't forget to rate us and subscribe on your favorite podcast platform. We'll see you next time.